Hey, everybody. It is Thursday, March 7th, National Cereal Day here in the U.S. You're listening to the Mo News Podcast. I'm Moshe Wanunu.
And I'm Jill Wagner. This is the place where we bring you just the facts.
And we read all the news and read between the lines so you don't have to. Some of you may be listening to this while eating a bowl of your breakfast cereal, or as Kellogg's would like you to do, have a bowl of cereal for dinner if you're listening to us late. Jill, welcome back.
Moshe, thank you for holding down the fort on a big night, Super Tuesday. I really appreciate it. I needed about 10 hours of sleep, and I finally feel like a normal person. I think my voice sounds
like
a little bit better.
Yeah.
Not painful for me or the listeners.
Well, we're glad to have you back as we close out a week here. As we like to say here on the pod, Jill, it is Friday Eve.
That's right. Happy Friday Eve, everybody. We're almost there.
And we have a lot of news to get to today.
All right, so here are the headlines, starting with politics. Some Super Tuesday fallout. Nikki Haley officially suspending her campaign, setting the stage for Trump versus Biden, the sequel. And Michelle Obama's office setting the record straight about a potential White House run for the former first lady.
She had to say it. Too many of you kept trying to push the rumors. We'll tell you what Michelle Obama is saying about running for president.
And how Biden is prepping for tonight's State of the Union, likely his biggest audience ahead of the November election.
We have our annual State of the Union bingo cards coming your way. We'll tell you about them.
To the Middle East, a Houthi attack on a shipping vessel off Yemen kills two people, the first deaths from the terror group's attacks. And closer to home, violence gets worse in Haiti as gangs there refuse to let the prime minister back in the country and threaten an all-out civil war. In New York, what the governor is doing to tackle surging crime on the subway. In economic news, when the Fed might start cutting interest rates. Where a type of whale that vanished from the Atlantic was spotted again after more than 200 years. And what is a coolcation and why it is the latest summer travel trend. Plus, Moshe is on this day in history.
Jill, it's the birthday for the telephone and the game of Monopoly. We'll tell you about the history for both.
All right, let's start with presidential politics, where the stage has been set for Donald Trump versus Joe Biden, part two. Nikki Haley officially suspending her presidential campaign on Wednesday after losing every state but Vermont in Super Tuesday's primary contests, ceding the Republican nomination to former President Trump. Her only other victory was the GOP primary in Washington, D.C. Now, as for whether she's going to throw her support behind Donald Trump, not quite yet.
I have always been a conservative Republican and always supported the Republican nominee. But on this question, as she did on so many others, Margaret Thatcher provided some good advice when she said, quote, never just follow the crowd. Always make up your own mind. It is now up to Donald Trump to earn the votes of those in our party and beyond it who did not support him. And I hope he does that.
One person who did back Donald Trump, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, they haven't spoken in more than 3 years after McConnell blamed Trump for the January 6th attack on the Capitol. But on Wednesday, shortly after Haley dropped out, he said, quote, it is abundantly clear that former President Trump has earned the requisite support of the Republican voters to be our nominee for president of the United States. It should come as no surprise that as nominee, he will have my support.
Yeah, we should say McConnell has had to endure hundreds of social media posts and mentions in Trump's speeches, mocking him, mocking his wife, sometimes in racist terms when it comes to his wife, who's originally from Taiwan. And yet, McConnell, a loyal Republican here, a reminder, things got so bad in 2021 after January 6th, McConnell was ready to convict him after he was impeached the second time on January 6th. And McConnell was hoping that enough Republicans would join him and Democrats to ban Trump from running again. Unfortunately for McConnell, as he looked around the following month there, not enough Republicans were ready to do that. And so here we are again. McConnell, who, by the way, is stepping down as leader, so he doesn't have to deal with Trump as leader next year if Trump is reelected, getting behind the president here. So if you have Mitch McConnell behind you, basically that means that most elected Republicans, if they haven't already gotten behind President Trump, they will be getting behind President Trump here. Exit polls do show, though, that a significant chunk of Haley voters are not ready to vote for Trump or do not intend to do so in the fall. For example, in North Carolina, that's a swing state with a growing population of college-educated Republican voters. 81% of those who voted for Haley said they would not be voting for Trump in November. Jill, we took a poll of Haley voters in the Mo News community on Instagram yesterday. Again, this is not scientific, but these are in rough terms what they told us. Of about 3,000 or so Haley voters who follow us on the Instagram account and chose to vote here in our poll, 50% of them said they would go to Biden, 20% to Trump, 15% to an independent candidate, TBD, and 15% said they would stay home. Obviously, this is just hours after she got out, so there's a lot of time between now and then. And you see the two sides making their pitches for the Haley voters. First, Biden. He released a statement on Wednesday inviting her supporters to join his team, so to speak. He wrote in his statement, "It takes a lot of courage to run for president. That's especially true in today's Republican Party. Nikki Haley was willing to speak the truth about Trump, about the chaos that follows him, about his inability to see right from wrong, about his cowering before Vladimir Putin. Trump has made clear he does not want you. I want to be clear, there is a place for all of you in my campaign." Then you had Trump release his statement. He says in his Truth Social post, "Nikki Haley got, in all caps, trounced last night in record-setting fashion. Much of her money came from radical left Democrats, as did many of her voters. At this point, I hope she stays in the race and fights until the end. I would further like to invite all Haley supporters to join the greatest movement in the history of our nation." All caps, "Biden is the enemy. He is destroying our country." So those are the two pitches so far from Joe Biden and Donald Trump for the Haley voters. But it's interesting, Jill, because Trump certainly has worked with Haley voters, but based on some of the numbers on Super Tuesday, it sounds like Biden has some work to do as well.
Right. So Biden won in a landslide on Super Tuesday. He's on the verge of locking in the nomination. But where he may pick up votes with moderates, he is facing challenges with progressives and younger voters in his own party. Like in Michigan, an uncommitted vote saw a bit of traction in a handful of states on Super Tuesday. It comes as progressive, Muslim, and some younger voters look to send a message to the president that he needs to support a permanent ceasefire in Gaza, and they are just not happy with how he has handled the Israel-Hamas war in general. Grassroots groups organized quickly after a similar effort in Michigan last week exceeded its goals with about 100,000 votes, or 13% of the vote. There were a few Super Tuesday states, Alabama, Colorado, Iowa, Massachusetts, North Carolina, and Tennessee, that had an option on the Democratic ballot where voters could decide not to commit to a specific candidate. In Minnesota, about 19% of voters chose uncommitted, which means a number of uncommitted delegates will go to the Democratic National Convention this summer. Minnesota has a large Muslim population and a large progressive voter base, all a factor in this increased protest vote. Speaking of Minnesota, three-term Minnesota Congressman Dean Phillips has officially ended his long-shot bid for the Democratic nomination. He is not very different policy-wise from Joe Biden. He did try to make the argument, though, that Biden is just too old for the job.
Yeah, he was running as a moderate, said, "I agree with everything Biden has done. I just think he's too old." But the age argument did not appear to be enough this cycle. Remember, Nikki Haley made the same case against Trump, saying, you know, he's just too old. I agree with him on some of these matters, but he's divisive and he's old. Dean Phillips said Biden's old, and it appears there was only a certain percentage of voters that really are voting on that factor. And so now in the fall, we'll have a 78-year-old versus an 81-year-old on the ballot. And despite people's complaints, it did not appear they were ready, at least in the two parties, to take up the younger options. Going back to the whole uncommitted situation, there's a lot of back and forth going on within the Democratic Party about how meaningful this is. We also spoke to folks who voted uncommitted in the various states in the Mo News community. I asked them, "What's your plan for the fall?" The vast majority of them saying, you know, "I just wanted to register my complaint that we didn't have options, my complaint about Biden's views, but I will be voting for Biden in the fall." There were a couple of people who said they will be going independent for an RFK Jr. type if he turns out to be on their ballot in their states. Remember, he's only on the ballot in two states right now, in Utah and New Hampshire, and has to spend a lot of money to get on all the ballots. You also have some independents like Cornel West and Jill Stein who might pick up some progressive votes. But for the most part, it appears, you know, it was just people letting off steam. The question is, how many of them will come back into the tent, and what case will Biden have to make to them to get them back within the tent?
Yeah, Nate Silver from 538 Politics, he has said that he thinks the media is overplaying the uncommitted vote, and he doesn't think that it's going to play a big role in November. I guess we'll see. I mean, he's the statistician.
He's a statistician. He's been right. He's also been very wrong, Jill. So we'll see what predictions will play out from Nate there. He certainly studies the numbers. But, you know, the media likes to look for a story in
this
what
is
was
all
otherwise...
we've got.
Well, yeah, it's been a very boring election, folks. We had that. We had American Samoa. Last night, I told you about that on yesterday's podcast. Like the random dude who spent $500,000 to get 51 votes to Biden's votes in American Samoa. This is what we got in what was a very boring race here. We should say major props to Nikki Haley, by the way. She was the first one to run against Trump, the last one to get out. She's the first female GOP candidate to win a primary. So certainly made some history in her own right. Another woman people have been talking about running for president, who's trying to put it to rest here, Michelle Obama, put out a statement in the last 24 hours. There's been this theory going around on the right-wing media for a while now that it's somehow Biden's going to step down, put Michelle Obama in as the candidate. Barack is running everything with no evidence. There's been zero evidence that this is the case, but people like to fantasize about it. Also, people on the left, Michelle Obama, probably one of the most popular people in America. Well, Michelle Obama's never really liked politics. And I've said this multiple times on this podcast, in our newsletter, on the Instagram account. She didn't like politics when her husband was president. She didn't want him to run for re-election in 2012. She hates it. And the fact that like people thought she would run for president, beyond wild. Well, there's been enough of it now where she put out her spokesperson and they said, listen, we got to cut this out. So they put out a statement yesterday, gave it to NBC. And this is what it says. As former First Lady Michelle Obama has expressed several times over the years, she will not be running for president. She supports President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris's re-election campaign. And that's that. That's the statement from Michelle Obama. People around her saying she will play a smaller role than her husband. Again, given that she does not like politics, she does not like it. She's enjoying being a media executive with her podcasting and continuing her post-White House career. So that's where we're at on that. She did tell Oprah during a Netflix special recently, politics is hard and the people who get into it, you've got to want it. It's got to be in your soul. It is not in my soul. Do you believe her, everybody?
I do, Bosch. I can tell you that.
It sounds like the people who want her to be president will literally have to drag her into politics.
Well, sticking with politics a bit longer, tonight, President Biden is giving his final State of the Union address before the election in November, likely one of his biggest audiences before Election Day. The New York Times is reporting that Biden spent last weekend drinking throat-soothing tea. Same-sie.
Sounds like someone I know. Yeah.
Guided by teleprompters and surrounded by six aides and one historian, John Meacham. Honing his State of the Union speech, he was at Camp David and he had a copy of the book Possible, How We Survive and Thrive in an Age of Conflict. It's from William Ury, an international negotiation expert.
Famous for the book Getting to Yes, if you've ever had to read that in a negotiation class.
The White House hasn't said which topics he'll hit tonight, but you could expect to hear Biden talk about, of course, the war between Israel and Hamas, the war in Ukraine, abortion, immigration, China, and other topics. His aides say they will continue editing the speech right until Biden gives it. So, Moshe, what will you be watching for?
Couple things. One, our favorite game every year, Designated Survivor. Who will have to stay behind for the unlikely scenario that the Capitol gets blown up and that person will have to run our government? You know, you might be familiar with it from the Kiefer Sutherland series that aired, but that's a real thing. They have to always pick a cabinet secretary, usually then a member of the Supreme Court, some members of Congress, who don't get to sit in the room in the, you know, a very unlikely, terrible, horrific circumstance that something bad happens. So that's just kind of a fun game to play. Usually find out about who that is about 5 minutes before the speech. The big thing, Jill, I think everyone will be watching for is energy level. He has to show the country he is up to it. He's asking the country to give him the keys to the car for 4 more years. So he's got to show that he can drive the car. And then the speech itself will give you a sense of where he'll take us on that trip. So the delivery is, give me the keys. And the speech itself is, here are the places I will take you. This is why I should give you 4 more years. So he'll effectively give us a recap of the last 4 years. What has he accomplished? You know, that's been one of the issues the White House has had here is their communication that I think it's fair to say has not been very good in terms of touting their accomplishments, explaining what they're doing. It is a key position being president, being key communicator, being the explainer in chief. And it's not a role that Biden really is comfortable with or has done particularly well. So that'll be interesting to see. You know, you mentioned some of the topics he'll get into. One of the other things we'll likely hear from him, how he has represented the average American and how he has saved them money. through eliminating junk fees. The credit card fee announcement from this week that they're capping credit card fees, late fees at $8. All the various things that he's doing to try to represent the American consumer, the accomplishment to bring down inflation. And of course, it'll be very interesting to hear him on immigration because he knows how resonant that issue is. We talked about his trip to the border last week. So how will he make his argument about immigration and the border at a time where the majority of Americans view him negatively on that? And frankly, a majority of Americans view him negatively. We will see what happens here. Presidents typically go draft by draft by draft, finalizing things as the hours and minutes get counted down. It'll get put into a teleprompter. And then, of course, one of the other things that you always have at the State of the Union, guests will look for who the special guests are that he has in the balcony sitting around the First Lady. Typically, people who are important for various points that he's making. I understand that among them will be an Israeli hostage who was released in November, who will be up in the balcony among other special guests.
And Moshe, in what has become a Mo News tradition, we're going to be putting out two State of the Union bingo cards, a real one and just a fun one.
Yes, we did it last year. For many of you, you're like, this is the only reason I watched the speech, to see if I could get bingo. So we'll have one where these are things that we think Biden might say that'll get you to bingo. And then a fun one with, you know, fantasy ideas or crazy things that could happen, or we wish they might happen. Both of them are linked in today's morning newsletter, as well as over on the Instagram account.
All right, plenty of news coming up. But first, we want to thank a few of our sponsors this week, starting with Factor Meal. At least in my house, I know we are pressed for time and we do still want to eat healthy and nutritious meals. And that's why we are so excited about Factor. It is America's number one ready-to-eat meal delivery service. They can help you fuel up fast for breakfast, lunch, and dinner with chef-prepared, dietitian-approved, ready-to-eat meals delivered straight to your door. I have been loving them. I grab them straight from the fridge, heat them up in the microwave, and they are legit delicious. They are not like frozen grocery store dinners. And you get to skip the extra trip to the grocery store, the shopping, the prepping, the cleaning up, while still getting the flavor and nutritional quality you need. You could choose from over 35 weekly meals. It's flexible with your schedule. Get as many or as little as you need. You could choose 6 to 18 meals per week. Plus, you can pause or reschedule your deliveries anytime. And do not sleep on their cold-pressed juices, shakes, and smoothies. I think the cold-pressed juices might be my favorite. So head to factormeals.com/monews50 and use the code monews50 to get 50% off. That is code monews50 at factormeals.com/monews50 to get 50% off. All right, time now for the speed read from the Wall Street Journal. At least two people on board a Barbados-flagged ship died after it was struck in an attack claimed by Yemen's Houthis on Wednesday. It is the first known loss of life since the group began attacking ships in the Red Sea in late November. The bulk carrier caught fire after being hit by a missile, forcing the crew to abandon the ship. At least two people were killed in the attack. That's according to the UK embassy in Yemen. And several sailors were also injured.
Yeah, yesterday we told you about those internet cables that were snipped. The Houthis are back above water here, it appears, continuing to attack commercial ships. This is something they say they've been doing in retaliation for Israel's war in Gaza since November, though the group has been targeting a lot of ships and other targets completely unrelated to that war. They've conducted more than 60 attacks now in the Red Sea over the past couple of months. The US, UK, and other allies continue to strike the Houthis on land, but it appears here they continue to have capability on the water. It comes as they sank a British ship in the last couple of weeks that had tons and tons of fertilizer on board, causing an environmental disaster in the Red Sea. So we'll continue to monitor that aspect of the conflict as it continues there.
From Agence France-Presse, or the AFP, as I prefer to pronounce it, the UN Security Council held an emergency meeting on Wednesday about the worsening situation in Haiti as the U.S. ramped up pressure on Prime Minister Ariel Henry to usher in a political settlement. He is still out of the country. Armed gangs who control swaths of the country launched a coordinated effort to oust Henry last week, attacking the airport, prisons, and police stations, and threatening a full-scale civil war. The U.S. is calling for the prime minister to hold free elections, but did not urge his resignation. That is a key demand of the powerful gang leader, Jimmy Charizier. He also goes by the nickname Barbecue. The prime minister has been in power since the 2021 assassination of the president, Jovenel Moïse. Henry was due to leave office in February, but instead agreed to a power-sharing deal with the opposition until new elections are held. Cherizier warned Tuesday that the worsening chaos would lead to civil war and genocidal bloodshed unless Henry stood down.
Yeah, it's a very concerning situation in Haiti, as we've been telling you on the pod in the past couple of weeks. You know, Haiti's always suffered from record poverty and violence on the island. It got worse after that devastating earthquake in 2010, which the island has never really recovered from. And then you had the assassination of the president, the appointment of this prime minister, but then this all-out gang warfare. Henry has been going around the world saying, I need help. Gangs control 80% of my capital. I don't have the military and police to deal with them right now. So while he was out of the country, the gangs seized the airport and they have blocked him from returning to Port-au-Prince, the capital of Haiti. The neighboring country, Dominican Republic, also rejected Henry's plane from landing there. So Ariel Henry landed in nearby Puerto Rico on a different island and has been trying to find alternate routes to get back into his country, again, of which he is the prime minister of. But the gangs here control a lot. We told you over the weekend about their prison break, letting out thousands and thousands of gang members from prison over the weekend. And the gangs here, led by this guy, again, he seriously goes by the name Barbecue. They have an alliance of gangs on the island. He says they're going to unleash the next wave of violence here. If the prime minister comes back, they've attacked police stations. They're looking to abduct and kidnap any members of the police as well as police leadership right now. And so you have this request by Haiti saying, world, please help us. The U.S. right now saying they're not going to send U.S. troops into Haiti to help with this. But potentially as part of an international coalition, Kenya has offered to lead that coalition. But the timing here is a question, and things have really escalated here while Henry's been outside the country.
All right, now to a local New York story that's getting a lot of national attention. This from NBC News in New York. The governor and head of the subway system outlined sweeping new state efforts, including deploying the National Guard to address rising subway crime in the city. Governor Kathy Hochul announcing her new 5-point plan, which includes adding state personnel to help with the NYPD bag checks, proposing a bill to allow judges to ban more violent offenders from the subway system, and adding new cameras for conductor cabins. Now, in terms of personnel, we're talking 750 National Guard members and 250 personnel from MTA and state police. Wednesday's developments come on the heels of New York City Mayor Eric Adams' announcement about enhanced bag checks at certain subway stations starting this week. Adams also saying the city continues to review metal detection technology for subway entry, but nothing is imminent.
We should keep in mind here, as we talk about the New York City subway system, that a billion people every year take the subway, several million people a day, I should say, including myself. And it is considered relatively safe, though they have seen an uptick here in crime, about 15% increase in felony assaults. There's been about 97 this year, up 13 from the same period in 2023, about 1.5 incidents a day, according to the numbers, again, with several million people riding the subway again, just to put it into context. Because I'll get messages, Jill, from people being like, oh my God, you're on the New York City subway system. I'm like, yeah. My odds actually are worse above ground with Uber drivers and taxi drivers than sometimes on the subway system, as far as I'm concerned. Though at the same time, clearly here, the state and the city taking this seriously with some incidents of attacks on MTA workers, on subway workers, as well as a handful of pushing incidents of passengers. Last year in 2023 was the highest number of subway assaults since the 90s. And that's actually the last time that we saw bag checks and some of the things they're implementing here. So clearly here, the state and the city trying to assuage the concerns of locals as well as tourists. You know, of course, you know, New York City being a huge city for tourists and business people.
Some economic news from CNBC. Fed Chair Jerome Powell on Wednesday reiterating that he does expect interest rates to start coming down this year, but is not ready to say when. Appearing before Congress, he said the Fed is still focused on the risks that come with inflation, and he doesn't want to ease up too quickly. The goal is to move toward 2% inflation. We're still at about a 2.4% annual rate, even higher when taking out food and energy prices. But it is much lower than we saw in 2022. Again, still not quite at the target. the Fed is trying to do a balancing act here. So they don't want to lower rates too quickly and risk inflation getting worse. But if they wait too long to make the cuts, it could pose a danger to economic growth and the job market.
Oh, the perils of being an economist, manipulating the world's largest economy here. They have the Goldilocks problem. They want it to be just right, not too hot, not too cold. And the numbers show that they got it right on the way up, as in they increased interest rates at a pace that was successful in bringing down inflation without putting the economy into a recession. And now they got to do the same dance on the way down. How and when do they lower the rates to, again, ensure they don't put us past an economic abyss of sorts? And that is what Jerome Powell and the folks around him at the Federal Reserve are focused on right now. One of the challenges, of course, is also presidential election year. So if you recall, especially during the Trump era, he would go after the Fed for decisions they would make. Biden, not so much in terms of open criticism of the Fed here. But you have seen some Democrats, including Liz Warren over in the Senate, calling on the Fed to reduce interest rates here, especially given the impact high interest rates are having on lower income families. So the Fed tries to stay out of politics. They work independent from politicians. And yet, because we're in an election year, politics will certainly be ever present as they make their calls.
From Yahoo News, a rare whale that has been extinct in the Atlantic Ocean for more than 200 years was recently spotted in the water off the coast of Massachusetts. This is according to the New England Aquarium, whose aerial survey team confirmed the sighting of a gray whale in the Atlantic about 30 miles south of Nantucket. It was on Friday, March 1st. One of the researchers at the aquarium said, "I didn't want to say out loud what it was because it seemed crazy." Another researcher who was also on the plane said, "My brain was trying to process what I was seeing because the animal was something that should not really exist in these waters. We were laughing because of how wild and exciting it was to see an animal that disappeared from the Atlantic hundreds of years ago."
Yeah, a bunch of them were in this plane and they're like, "Oh my God, like, please keep doing loops over this. Like, we have to make sure what we're seeing here is what we think it is." Gray whales, by the way, are typically found in the North Pacific Ocean, and they are distinguished from other whale types because they lack a dorsal fin, they have gray and white skin, and they have a dorsal hump with pronounced ridges. These science folks tell me. Some people are like, "Mosh, how do you know that?" I was like, "I don't know that."
It's not just politics that you get with Mosh. It is bio. It's science. It's everything.
Oh, wait for it. There's a piece of what I'm about to say here that I actually do know. Descriptions of gray whales I did have to look up. Based on what we understand here, the gray whale effectively disappeared from the Atlantic Ocean by the 18th century. This is a couple hundred years ago because humans killed them off. There were massive whale hunts, and effectively we humans ensured there were no gray whales in the Atlantic Ocean. But one of the theories now as to why gray whales have returned, climate change. An ice-free passage, we told you about it on yesterday's podcast, in the Arctic is now ensuring that whales are able to go from the North Pacific into the North Atlantic through ice-free waters, and now they're appearing in the Atlantic Ocean. So that's something that was not possible until recently, but now that we have some of these ice-free summers or nearly ice-free summers, the whales appear to be traveling in between. Jill, my regular reminder here, I think I've said this a couple times on the podcast, how important whales are to the environment in fighting climate change. This is something we addressed on a podcast recently. Believe it or not, folks, whale poop is super, super important to cutting down carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So whale poop is nutrient rich. I bet you didn't think you were going to get this on today's podcast. And they boost plankton blooms in the ocean. The plankton is very effective at capturing CO2 and then putting off oxygen into the atmosphere. In fact, phytoplankton, which again uses whale poop as fertilizer, captures 37 billion tons of CO2, which is four Amazons worth. The entire Amazon rainforest times four, that's how much CO2 is being taken out by phytoplankton in the ocean. So more whale poop helps more CO2, helps the phytoplankton take out more CO2 and produce more oxygen. So this is why whales are important and why we should ensure that we are preserving our whales, taking care of our whales after, by the way, humans have killed about 97 to 98% of all whales on Earth. By the way, when whales die, they sink to the bottom of the ocean and they also take in a lot of CO2. So they are among the things that are key to fighting climate change here, much more significant than planting trees or even 1,000 trees. So that is something I discussed on a recent podcast. We did an interview with Paul Nicklin and Christina Mittermeier, who are incredible wildlife photographers and environmentalists. We'll include the link in the show notes to the discussion of the oceans, but also an even better explanation, because I learned this from Christina Mittermeier, of the impact of whale poop.
I just Googled whale poop while you were talking, and the first thing that came up was whale poop perfume. That's weird.
I don't know about that, Jill, and I don't know why that was the first thing that came up, but but I will tell you, really important for phytoplankton. That's what I do know.
From Axios, summer vacations in colder climates like the Arctic are getting more popular as people turn to coolcations to avoid record-breaking heat. Condé Nast Traveler named coolcationing one of the biggest travel trends to expect in 2024, noting that heat waves are making a summer vacation in Norway seem more appealing than one in Sicily or southern France. The magazine says booking travel in temperate destinations also has the benefit of cities being less crowded, at least for now. Iceland, Finland, and Scotland, already popular for summer travel, are getting even more so. And the Baltic nations are also on the rise.
Yeah, there's the temperature and there are the prices. If you've tried to book a vacation recently to places like Italy, Greece, Spain, Portugal, hot when it comes to demand, hot when it comes to temperature. So you have been seeing more people booking in Northern Europe and other northern locations. A British travel company tells the paper it saw demand for Arctic destinations increase 235% last year versus the year before. Though, Jill, just to put this in context, we're not talking about the majority of people traveling to these places, right? Italy, the Parises of the world, still pretty popular.
Yeah, reality check here. The top travel destinations in 2023 were Paris, Dubai, Madrid, Tokyo, and Amsterdam. As they note in this article, no one is saying, oh, I can't possibly go to Tuscany. You know, they're still, Italy is still a top destination. Although I did have a friend who went last summer during the heat wave, and she said it was miserable. She was like, there was no air conditioning in our hotel. We had to switch to a different hotel. So the heat is a real issue. I also thought it was fascinating what else Condé Nast Traveler was predicting that were going to be the big trends in travel: home swapping, frontier tourism, eco diving, and something that they're calling skip gen travel, which is when grandparents go on trips with their grandchildren. I guess the generation that they're skipping is the parents.
Yeah. Carol Wagner taking the kids anywhere this summer?
I think they need to get a little bit older. But yes, I'm totally all about this trend. I think it's awesome.
All right. Now time for On This Day in History. On this day in 1876, 29-year-old Alexander Graham Bell receives a patent for his new invention, the telephone. Just a couple days later, he would make his first telephone call as he demonstrated his ability to, quote, talk with electricity. So Graham Bell, the first phone call ever made, is Graham Bell calling over to his assistant in the next room, Thomas Watson, and the first words uttered, Mr. Watson, come here. I want to see you. So if you're looking for that piece of trivia, by the way, just several months later, Graham Bell would demonstrate it for the public, and Watson was in a different building. So that was the first, quote, unquote, long distance call. The first phone calls, including the first call this week in history, being a call to the other room. Jill, does anybody actually still call another person on the phone anymore, or is it all texting?
I do. Actually, I'm still a big phone talker.
To another invention today, on this date in 1933, Monopoly turns 91 years old today. On this date in 1933, Charles Darrow created, or we think, created the game Monopoly with three other designers. The board that they created was a circular board. There were, though, a few other games very similar to Monopoly, including one called the Landlord Game, which Monopoly was derived from. It turns out Darrow, by the way, would go to a friend's place, play this Landlord Game. The friend knew the rules by heart. And at some point, Darrow's like, can you write down the rules for me? And they're like, why? Well, because Darrow wanted to make some money off this whole thing. As far as the playing pieces are concerned, the iron and the thimble, these were all things Darrow found in his house, at least as he tells it. Also, the boards, various places you can buy, are based on places in Atlantic City. So he showed his game to Milton Bradley, one game company. They rejected it. Parker Brothers, though, said, yeah, we think you have something here, Darrow. So Parker Brothers would turn it into a thing, make tons of money off of it. So would Darrow. Now to the truth, Jill, that would come out years later. A woman named Lizzie McGee had actually invented the Landlord Game 30 years before Darrow, came up with the whole concept. She had put it out there, though it didn't gain much traction. And that apparently was the game which Darrow would play at his friend's house. So McGee, by the way, as Parker Brothers tried to make sure they had everything kosher to continue to sell this, paid McGee $500 for the rights to her game so they could have the trademark on everything. She would only find out later as to why they paid her $500 for it when she finds out that Monopoly, derived from her landlord game, was selling like hotcakes out there, and other people were making millions of dollars off the entire thing. So McGee does a bunch of interviews, frustrated about the whole story. So we just here on the Mo News podcast want to give Lizzie McGee her due and not give all credit to Charles Darrow. All right, and then fast forward now to 1987. On this day, a boxer by the name of Mike Tyson became the youngest heavyweight champion at the age of 20. He acquired the World Boxing Association championship belt. Mike Tyson on this day in history. We end here with a bit of music history. On that same day, March 7th, 1987, the Beastie Boys make pop history as the first hip-hop act to have a number one album with their album License to Ill. It featured You Gotta Fight for Your Right to Party, Brass Monkey, and No Sleep Till Brooklyn. So a lot of bangers on that first Beastie Boys album.
We are big Beastie Boy fans in this house. And my daughter actually has a Beastie Boys shirt. And it says Beastie Boys in the front. And then on the back, it's a few B's. Tea, like a cup of tea. Mm-hmm. And then boys, like a picture of boys. And it's, they're very literal.
Jill, we should just note as we talk about the Beastie Boys, they're all about to turn 60 if they haven't already in the next couple of years.
Why do you do this to me, Mosh? Is this what I need?
Jill, on this day in history, we're just trying to keep it real. Jill, before we go, on this day in history, Dina Silverman was born. We mention her because I'm told by her friends that she is a huge Mo News listener and has recruited, according to one friend, at least 100 listeners for the Mo News podcast. So a happy birthday, a special shout out to Dina. If you claim to also have recruited 100 listeners for the Mo News podcast, you too will get a shout out here on the Mo News Pod.
Well, Dina, happy birthday. And thank you so much. We appreciate the support. And we also want to thank everyone else who is listening to the Mo News Podcast. If you like what you hear, share this with your friends like Dina. It will help us grow. Follow us and subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and review us in the App Store.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like Dina has any more friends to, she's already gotten 100 people aboard. Now, I'm not diminishing you, Dina. You might have more than 100 friends, but we're very grateful for your 100 friends.
I don't know 100 people that I could recommend a podcast to. I guess if you do it over social media.
You do, Jill. You have like 7,000 people over on your Instagram account, last I checked. That said, we appreciate the good word. We appreciate you reaching out to your friends, family, colleagues, strangers, baristas at your local coffee joint to get them to join and listen to the Mo News Pod. Follow us on Instagram and subscribe to the Mo Newsletter.
Okay, bye, everybody.
Later.
Thanks for listening to the Mo News Podcast.